Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm here in the studio with Stephen Thompson. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
So Stephen and I are here in the studio today because as you hear this, we're on the road.
That's right.
We are traveling. We are doing
live shows.
We're riding the rails out on the West Coast. And I know that some of you, even as you listen to this, either are going to come and see us or perhaps you even already have seen us. We're so grateful for all of your support. But it means we are not in the studio to
do
a regular episode this week. So fortunately, we realized that right around now, there are a couple things that are returning that we have talked about in the past. And one of them is the terrific CW show, Jane the Virgin, which we really like. Yeah, good show. And a while back, we had a conversation about Jane the Virgin with our friend Barry Hardiman. And we thought that we would listen to that segment again. And so here is that conversation about Jane the Virgin. So one of the reasons why we invited Barry is that she came up on our list of folks who are interested in Jane the Virgin. Now, Jane the Virgin started in the fall of 2014 on the CW. It's an hour-long, what would you call it, a comedic drama, dramatic comedy, both sort of is a telenovela and is sending up telenovelas. It's in that kind of enchanted genre where you both are doing the thing and sending up the thing.
If you want more of a plot description for this show, all you have to do is watch the first 30 seconds of any episode of it, and it will tell you the complete story.
Hola, it's me again. Let's review. By now, you all know the deal. Jane was accidentally artificially inseminated.
But I've never had sex!
You know who wasn't thrilled with this development? Jane's detective boyfriend, Michael.
Ross, don't have this baby.
But Jane decided to have it.
In the voice of the wonderful narrator, who I think
I love him so much.
Right. The narrator on Jane the Virgin is pretty much the best character on television.
The credits call him the Latin lover narrator.
Yeah. And you know, actually, I am usually not a person who likes voiceover, and I love this so much. I love it. It's like, it's one of my favorite things about the series.
But it's teasing the notion of voiceover. You know, it is important to
know. Which is why I
like it. Not important to know, but it is important to know. It is important for her to know, but she doesn't know. They do, like, lots and lots and lots of that in a way that I found instantly charming. I mean, I was hooked on this show in about the first 40 seconds.
Yeah, and they similarly type words on the screen to explain who people are. And some of that is for comedy, and some of that is just
for actual exposition.
To help you keep up with this crazy storyline.
Because it is as complicated as a telenovela.
Right. It is the constant, ceaseless churning of plot, of event upon event. here's the plot of tonight's episode. Crazy crap happens. And then, so if you're looking for a nuanced character study, you know, this isn't it. I mean, it is grounded by the performance of Gina Rodriguez, striking this great balance between the character is idealistic but not naive.
Right.
She's open and warm, but she's intelligent, which is not something you see a lot, especially in telenovelas, which tend to push people to very, very broad types.
Right.
Yeah. And she could be annoying. She feels so real. I mean, I remember the second episode where she starts crying after she's seen the sonogram. I felt very moved by it, even though this is essentially kind of a campy, sort of silly show, but it's got such a warm beating heart in the form, really, of Gina Rodriguez.
I wrote down warm beating heart next to the words Gina Rodriguez in my notes. And she is so crucial to the enjoyment of this show. It is shows of this type, your big, soapy, revenge type shows, are very often pitting varying degrees of nasty people against each other.
Yes.
And while there are most definitely nasty scenery chewing people on this show, chewing scenery nastily, there are also like all of these people who are just goobers. They introduce, and it's one of my favorite little flourishes in the show, she doesn't know yet that her father is actually the star of the big telenovela, who starts out as just a purely fictional construct and then actually is woven into her life. He is just this ridiculous, self-infatuated buffoon, but he's lovable at the same time.
So she
is definitely the conscience of the show. She is the moral center of the show. Mm-hmm. And yet there are other decent people.
Oh, well,
lots of them.
A lot of this show does have her involved with a couple of different guys, But it is very much built about her relationships with her mother and her grandmother. Mm-hmm. You know, these three generations of the women in this family who have these really close relationships and love each other very much and rely on each other very much. You know, not for nothing, but this is also a show where you get to hear a bunch of people speak Spanish to each other, yes. which the show does not yep. replace with English. There are times when they speak English to each other, mm-hmm. but at times when they might most logically speak Spanish to each other, it shows them speaking Spanish to each other,
right.
because that way you don't get another layer of kind of artificiality.
Right. In a really smart move, the pilot had the grandmother speaking in English, but then as soon as the pilot was done, she goes back most of the time Spanish with English subtitles.
Yeah.
Really smart.
When they presented this show at Press Tour last July, I give the critics at that thing a lot of credit for the fact that people were pretty instantly taken with this show. I actually asked the question because in the pilot that we saw, the version that we saw, she spoke Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
But in the sizzle reel, the advertising sizzle reel, in the same moment, she spoke English.
Right.
And it was clear that they mm-hmm. were very conscious of, they want that to be part of the show, but they don't mm-hmm. necessarily want people to feel like they're going to constantly be looking at subtitles. And
right.
so it was clear that they were walking a line there. Now, the top line out of that Press Tour session was everybody was instantly in love with Gina Rodriguez,
sure,
who gave
yeah.
this wonderful, mm-hmm. you know, went into this wonderful speech about how she turned down a role on the show Devious Maids.
That's right.
Because she basically said, you know, look, I mean, she came as close as you'll ever see an actor come to naming a specific show and saying, I wanted better for myself than
yeah.
that.
Now, the show is set in Miami. Miami's about 35% Cuban, but they're playing it very close to the chest with mm-hmm. exactly where they are. She's Latina.
Well,
there
is a moment in one of the very recent episodes where they suggest it's Venezuela.
Okay. All right.
But you're right. That is not a major element
sure.
to specify it in that
now,
way.
Now, if you watch the show with somebody who lived in Miami through most of their adolescence and early childhood, you get an extra layer.
Mm-hmm.
That layer is a lot of cursing. Because it's like, look at that arid palm tree, you might say.
Yeah.
Or look at that. They think that's Coconut Grove. That's not Coconut Grove. That's Long Beach, California. Or
okay.
this is just Dexter all over again. Look, Burn Notice filmed in Miami. Why can't Dexter play? But I have seen some carping online about how, you know, no straight man wears shirts this tight.
Uh-huh.
And I want to say, that's the one thing they got right about Miami. The one thing.
Okay, so speaking of men, the basic setup of Jane the Virgin, mm-hmm. which comes out in about the first 20 minutes of the pilot, she is a virgin, she goes to the gynecologist, and she's accidentally inseminated instead of given a pap smear, because you know how that can happen.
Yeah.
And so you have her in contact with both her fiancé, whose name is Michael, and Raphael, who is the guy whose product she is inseminated with.
It's actually conditioner.
It's a tough economy. So she winds up in this very, as you can imagine, unusual situation where she is pregnant, but she is a virgin. One of the things that's interesting, Stephen talked about kind of how there are a lot of decent people in this show.
Mm-hmm.
I have always been a Raphael person. I always have responded much more to him, and I've always mm-hmm. felt like he was much more attractive to me. It's partly just a type thing,
sure.
I guess. But I was very surprised to find out that there are hardline Michael partisans. I just assumed everyone was a Raphael
yeah.
person.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to ruin the diversity of this panel on that, but I'm a Raphael gal myself.
Yeah.
I like the emotionally, like, damaged, vulnerable, hunky
yeah.
kind of dude.
It's
you know, and I like Tall, Dark, and Handsome. So.
Well, could I just go to bat mm-hmm. for neither of them?
Yeah. Good. Go
was,
for it.
You can.
That was kind of my initial thing, is I'm like, well, part of it is they do a nice job of allowing it to unfold the extent to which you should trust either of these dudes.
Mm-hmm.
They establish up front
yeah.
that Michael is not necessarily everything that he's
right.
cracked up to be. They're very clear that Raphael, especially at first, is not everything mm-hmm. that you might want him to be.
That I might want him to be, is what you're saying. I get it.
And
I
so
get it.
So ultimately, I just think she should just go for plan C.
Yeah.
It's
you know,
about her.
I've been watching Justin Baldoni, his career, since he exploded onto our screens in 2005 in Spring Break Shark Attack.
Which one is he?
Raphael.
He's Raphael.
Yeah.
And he has trouble fitting into his shirts. Now, did either of you guys watch Ugly Betty? Did any of you people mm-hmm. watch
Ugly Betty? I did.
I watched a fair amount of it.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I was talking about this show over the weekend with some friends, and they were saying, the thing is that every episode has plot, big, mm-hmm. huge thing that happens, plus a lot mm-hmm. of filler. And on Ugly Betty, that filler was Michael Urie being catty and lots of sniping. Jokes, in other words. Right. Jokes. And here, mm-hmm. it's not dialogue wit. It's what you guys were talking about before, heart and sweetness.
Right.
Is that approximately right?
Does
that
I think to a certain extent. I was surprised. I watched several episodes at work, as one does, and found myself occasionally like swallowing back like a cackle. Like I would suddenly mm-hmm. like try not to laugh out loud at a show that I don't think of as having a ton of jokes, but it's very nice at pacing its situations mm-hmm. in ways that made me laugh more than I would have necessarily expected to.
There's also a lot of humor that comes from the show's playing around with form, both mm-hmm. the narrator,
the narrator,
the captioning, mm-hmm. the way they like to poke fun at the rhythm of the show while still doing it. There is a having your cake and eating it too
totally.
Thing that happens with this mm-hmm. show where they're making fun of themselves for being this very...
For being so heavily expositional.
Well, right. And also being this very, as Glenn said, plot, driven kind of, you know, festival of nuttiness. Mm-hmm. And yet they're still doing it.
Right.
And so they get to both be the thing and also make fun of the thing, you know?
Yeah.
So one of the things that I thought was very interesting is this past episode addressed immigration in a very overt way. And it did it in an episode in which was one of the more, it was much more religion heavy. I mean,
yes.
there is obviously they're Catholic, but this episode was particularly heavy where you have Jane going to retrieve her rosary. And so you kind of have these two different behaviors. One is this kind of prayer, and which is a sort of maybe something we think of as more of a conservative thing. And then you also have this other issue of immigration reform. And instead of sort of being in the same boxes that you normally would, like, they're not in the typical conservative liberal boxes.
I think that's right. No, I think that's right.
And so it's getting to sort of have its cake and eat it too with these issues as well of being a show that is delightful, but is also addressing this particular issue that is real, but is also still filled with whimsy. And so you don't actually wonder why any of the characters are doing what they do. That stuff seems real, even though it is a fully whimsical world.
I think you raise an interesting point, which is, of the many kinds of diversity that this mm-hmm. show helps to increase, and diversity has become one of those very difficult mm-hmm. words that's, you know, hard to define what it means to different people, and it becomes mm-hmm. a word that sort of doesn't mm-hmm. mean anything unless you specify. But in addition to being a show that features, you know, for example, a young Latina heroine, which is not mm-hmm. common on television, among the kinds of things that I think this show serves that aren't always well served is that this is a family to whom religion is very important. And although, mm-hmm. like everything on the show, there is a sense of humor about that. There is mm-hmm. a sense of humor about aspects of being Catholic, just like mm-hmm. there is aspects of anything else. But their religion remains a central thing to them, and it is not made fun of. No, that in and of itself is not used for comedy, and it's not used to delegitimize the things that they're saying. And so I think, you know, there are a bunch of ways in which you don't get a lot of characters like this on English language American television. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is one of them.
One of the things that sets telenovelas apart, one of the many things, is that they only run for a few months. They have a beginning, middle, and end. So even though there is this churn of plot and there's all these reversals and alliances form and then dissolve and then they're back the next day, mm-hmm. it does end. Jane the Virgin has just been picked up for a next season, and it's going to go on for as long as it goes on. Mm-hmm. And yet the churning of these characters through all the back and forth that they're going through is just going to keep going. And at some point, she's going to have the kid. Mm-hmm. At the rate they're going, I think we're only like a day after somebody was murdered, and everybody's like, yep, whatever. Uh-huh. it's just long-term consequences. It isn't what this particular show is about,
right.
And yet it's going to have to address that.
I found the sudden murderiness of it a little surprising, because for a while it is such a chewy little fun confection,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
all of a sudden it gets bigger and grander mm-hmm. and soapier, and the stakes get bigger and wilder and crazier.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it maintains that fizzy quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
You, Glenn, said something interesting, and I want to push back against a little bit. You were saying that there's an enormous amount of heart in this show.
Sure.
That is a big part of it. Do you like it anyway?
I do think it's really engaging, light, and frothy. And when it's sitting there on my DVR and it's like, what do you want to watch tonight? I'll think to myself, I'll just remember all those heart-tugging parts, and I'll be like, eh, maybe not. But then I will remember Rogelio.
Rogelio.
Anything that Rogelio does. And I like that they are...
That is the father.
That is the father.
The father who is a giant telenovela star.
Who is very, very funny. And I like that they're using him sparingly. I think the little of that guy goes a long way. As soon as we start to get make it more... This is what I'm... Another reason I'm worried about where the series goes, because if it becomes the Rogelio show, then there's that...
He gets a little irkly.
Yeah, yeah. He will get a little irkly.
And it must be so tempting to do that. Because he's so funny.
Yeah. You know what is one thing about it that I have to say that I think I haven't seen in a show that I liked this much in a long time is it appears to have no cynicism.
Mm. Right.
I mean, and it, there's nothing coming back to bite you. Mm-hmm. And that is such a relief because I watch so much HBO. You know, like I watch so much, I see so much stuff on television about how terrible the world is that it is sometimes really just such a lovely break to say, wouldn't it be nice to see a group of like basically decent people and then some really funny villains doing some stuff? That gives me that Gilmore Girls feeling of like,
I think Gilmore Girls is a great comparison, despite the fact that it had, well, it had a different kind of stylized form. Mm-hmm. But I think it feels
similar to me.
There's
for
a
some
lot.
Reason.
I think there's a lot to that comparison, which has never occurred to me before. But
and
I'll take it.
And if the show could also include, Terry from Three's Company in a wheelchair, doing a Boris Badenov accent,
that's true.
More is the pleasure.
Sold.
Bring it on.
Bring it on, indeed.
This show does fit into that pop culture comfort food.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Slot that we've talked about before.
Yes, it does. Yes.
And it's weird because obviously it's very, very different from Parks and Rec. Mm-hmm. But it has a little bit of that same, this is just a warm, sweet show. Like if Parks and Rec had occasional murder.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
I liked that, Stephen. That was a good line about if Parks and Rec had occasional murder.
Stopped clock twice a day, etc.
That's right. When we come back, we're going to talk about another CW show, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from LEGO. Every girl is different, but research has shown that girls' self-esteem peaks at age 9, and confidence can begin to drop. They can become less likely to try, to take risks, to expose their vulnerability. LEGO encourages exploration and stimulates creativity. Whether it's with a Minecraft or a friend set, girls can keep building their world brick by brick. Learn more at Pinterest.com/LEGO.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. As we've already explained, we are on the road this week, so we are looking back at a couple of our favorite segments about shows that are returning to television right around now. And the other one that we want to talk about today is Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And so a while back, during the show's first season, we invited our friend Kat Chow of Code Switch to come and talk to us about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So here's a little bit of that. So Glenn has been talking for months about how much he enjoys the CW show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of it, too. But this week, we decided to dive in a little. Co-created by Aline Brosh McKenna and the star of the show, Rachel Bloom, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend follows Rebecca Bunch, who, the theme song sort of explains it. So can we get that clip, Jess?
I was working hard at a New York job, making dough, but it made me blue. One day I was crying a lot, and so I decided to move to West Covina, California. Brand new pals and new career. It happens to be where Josh lives, but that's not why I'm here.
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
What? No, I'm not.
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
That's a sexist term.
She's the crazy ex-girlfriend.
Can you guys stop singing for just a second?
She's so broken inside.
The situation's a lot more nuanced than that.
C-R-A-Z-Y.
Okay, we get it.
Crazy ex-girlfriend.
So as that song sums up, Rebecca was an unhappy lawyer in New York who moved to the town of West Covina, California, to try to be happy after learning that her long-ago summer camp boyfriend, Josh Chan, with whom she'd been long out of touch, was living there. So, Glenn, can you talk a little bit about what it is that you think you respond to in this show?
The songs. Mm-hmm. I mean, the show is great. I find that I keep going back and revisiting and keep going back and keep going back and mm-hmm. revisiting the songs, not necessarily rewatching the episodes, because it seems to me that the songs are just concentrated forms of what makes everything about this show so good. They're smart. They're very funny. The quality goes up and down. I have definitively ranked all 18 songs that have been played so far.
Nice.
In case we hit a lull.
That'll
really good podcasting.
Help.
Yeah. But these these songs meant, like, you should be warned if you're going to start this show that they are the musical equivalent of a seti eel. They're like a seti eel in a dance belt. They crawl inside your head and they wrap around your spinal column. And they are inescapable. So, for example, in my house for the past few weeks, if I happen to be in a part of the house and I'm looking for something and I ask where something is, or one of us mentions the room that houses the toilet, this is what happens.
Where's the bathroom? Where's the bathroom? I need to use the bathroom. Tell me that you have a bathroom in this hovel you call home. I don't know.
Oh, that is
from her horrible mother.
Her horrible mother. That is, of course, Tova Feltsche. I think she's Swiss. No, of course not.
And like Tova Feltsche.
Playing Rachel's mother in a very, very, not nuanced performance, but really sells it. A really great song that consolidates, that distills all of this motherly angst into one great showstopping number.
Yeah, and it's not all, it starts off with so much just picking at her about her skin and her weight and stuff like that, but then it goes into what happens in lots of visits with lots of people who you're uncomfortable with, which is that they also want to talk about a bunch of things you don't care about.
Yep.
Oh, did you hear? A bishop in Wisconsin said something anti-Semitic, so the temple has decided to boycott cheddar cheese.
And it's really, that song kind of goes on and is so great. And Tova Feltsche, I mean, seriously, if you are a Law and Order person, you have seen her many, many, many times as one of the most popular and widely used attorneys on that show. It was so lovely to me to see her in something so different and funny and light, right. And it's such a good use, I think, of her.
Yeah, she's a Broadway star. She has been for decades, and she's just in her element here. And that's it. There's not a dud in this cast. Right. Everybody is bringing something, bringing their A-game. I love Daryl, who is a weird little character, plays her boss, but that actor, Pete Gardner, is just so nailing it. There's a great song called I Love My Daughter.
Yes. Oh, yes.
That he totally sells.
'Cause I love my daughter, but not in a creepy way. Though I realize father-daughter love comes off that way. I just love my daughter, but again, not in a creepy way.
Yeah, it's kind of the I Love My Daughter song is kind of one of these creepy.
It's really creepy.
Yeah, it makes you so uncomfortable.
If you think about the kind of glurgy father-daughter songs, the whole, was it Butterfly Kisses? Is that the one I'm thinking of? These kind of vaguely unsettling, fixated on the daughter song. And that's one of the things I like about the show is that so many of the songs are such specific pastiche pieces about some particular genre of music.
We should credit the songwriters. I mean, Rachel Bloom wrote a lot of the lyrics, but she collaborated with Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne.
I didn't even know that. He's written a bunch of like Broadway and movie
and TV stuff. EGOT nominated.
Mm-hmm. And Rachel Bloom herself has such a good background, too. I mean, her videos of, what was it, the Disney princesses? Mm-hmm. You guys remember that? That was amazing.
Yeah.
And so I just love her comedy too.
You had not really watched this show, Kat, is that right?
No. Yeah, I hadn't watched it. I kept hearing about it because people would tweet about me because of this Josh Chan character. Mm. And for the longest time, I put off watching it because I thought this was going to be like a selfie situation where, like the case of colorblind casting, where they just took, you know, an actor and who happened to be Asian and put him in there. But as I've been watching it, this is one of my favorite shows that I have seen on now. And Josh Chan, he's a Filipino-American, Vincent Rodriguez III. And his character is just so funny and kind of brutish on it, where he kind of seems sort of like a dud, you know, where you're watching him and you think he's kind of like this Asian bro, but there's so much more to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when she eventually goes and spends some time with his family, it's a very specific portrayal of this family that
totally
is pretty specific. Specifically, a Filipino-American family. And I think there are some really good interviews with Rachel Bloom where she's talked about this, where she kind of says, like, where I grew up in California, there were tons of, like, Asian bros that I never saw them on television.
I know, this is her reality.
I think she said the prom king at her high school was Asian. And she sort of said, like, I just never saw this represented on television. So to me, this was a very natural kind of thing to do. But I agree with you. At the beginning, he really seems like kind of a nothing, which is sort of part of the story. Mm-hmm. She goes all the way out there, and then you're like, that guy? Really? And you can kind of tell she's making it more than it is.
Sure, she's built him up.
But then he becomes, I feel like he redeems himself the later part.
One of the things that's really interesting about it, I think, is that I was debating with people during the airing of, by the time you hear this episode, it will have been the second to most recent one, what the end game of the show is and mm-hmm. whether or not Josh Chan getting together with her is the end game of the show or not. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of remarkable to realize that you can actually debate that because people aren't sure. It's right. not yeah. clear whether it's right. her, whether it's him, or there's a friend of his whose name is Greg, who's played by Santino Fontana, who I also love. And I want to take a moment. Santino Fontana is also a song and dance man, as it turns out. I really love this one.
But I know there's another guy you fancy more. So even though I'm not the one you adore, why not settle for me? Darling, just settle for me. I think you'll have to agree, we make quite a pair.
That little song, Settle For Me, turns into a sort of fantasy black and white Astaire and Rogers dance number. And it's really funny because it's such a dark sentiment. And yet it's being done in that very funny way. But I like the fact that Greg is a guy who kind of is infatuated with her initially, and then she acts like she acts. And he then legitimately doesn't like her.
Exactly.
It's not that he finds her enchantingly goofy. He really doesn't like her.
It's important that there's movement on this show mm-hmm. and that the people make decisions, bad decisions, invariably bad decisions, and, and that those have consequences. So it's not the same show it was in the first episode. Right. We're not seeing the same dynamic repeated over again. It's yeah. getting deeper, and it's actually progressing in a way that I didn't expect it to.
I was surprised at how much I liked this show from the pilot. I did find that the first few episodes are very heavily tilted toward sort of cringe comedy mm-hmm. in ways that if I'm not quite in the mood for cringe comedy, I'll watch it in 5 to 10 minute fits and starts and have to pause to collect myself. I have the actually the same reaction sometimes to The Bachelor.
Yeah, nice.
I noticed you guys brought clips from songs. I actually brought a snippet of dialogue. Can you believe it?
Oh,
I mean, they're
dialogue.
Only like, the songs are doled out fairly sparingly in this show. I mean, you mentioned there are 18 in, what, 9 episodes?
Yeah, only usually about a couple.
I found that the use of songs very similar to the use of songs in, like, Flight of the Conchords, mm-hmm. yeah. where it's just weaving in a couple of them. They get bang for their buck with the songs. But I actually brought a clip of, it's from the first episode. It's Greg asking Rebecca out on a date. And it's just, it is this perfect moment where you just instantly love him.
Do you want to go?
Yeah, is there, like, a paperless post that I should reply to?
Why don't we just go together?
Great, yeah. Okay, so you'll come to me in a car?
Yes, like a date, because you're pretty and you're smart and you're ignoring me, so you're obviously my type.
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Perfect.
And meanwhile, she's like looking around.
Yeah, she's waiting.
For Josh.
She's like, she's looking around for Josh.
Yeah.
But that the line read of perfect.
Yeah.
is so yeah. charming. And I like the fact that they, instead of, like you said, Glenn, having him kind of stay in that lane, they bring out darker and darker. They certainly bring out a lot of sweetness in him, mm-hmm. but he's not just sweet. He's not just doting. Mm-hmm. I love that character.
Yeah. I think it's fair to mention that a lot of people have been uncomfortable with the title of this show mm-hmm. and to some degree with the premise of this show. The producers, Rachel Bloom and also Aline Brash McKenna and some of the other people associated with the show, took some questions at the press tour last summer about calling it Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and kind of said, we're glad you asked because for us, it's really about exploring the limitations of that as a stereotype. And I think they mean that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think the show makes clear that it is happy to deal on all fours with the fact that Rebecca has issues of anxiety and depression and things like that. And she talks about that. But the summing up of her as Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is something that clearly the show is about how not the point that is.
Right.
And yet it has really turned people off, some people, not just because of the title, but I think the entire premise is a little cringy. And when I first was watching the show in the first couple episodes, my thought was, I really like her. I really love some of the other people who are on the show, Donalyn Champlin, who Glenn has talked about mm-hmm. in the past, who plays Paula, her friend. I love all those people, and yet I wanted it to be less about Josh. I wanted it to be mm-hmm. less about her actually sitting around and waiting for Josh. And I have mixed feelings about the fact that he has stayed so much part of the show, because as Kat said, he's turned out to be a much more interesting character,
right.
I think,
yeah.
and brings out different things in her than I originally expected. And yet, when I started watching it, I sort of thought, well, the way that this is going is it's not really about him. It's really about her looking for something different in her life. And I sort of expected him to be a little more of a red herring.
Mm-hmm.
And I have mixed feelings about the fact that that's not the case.
That he's still an actual love interest.
Yeah. And I still, you know, one of the things I talked about on our New Year's episode is dealing with those things where you stay in that tension of I don't like everything about it. There are mm-hmm. things about it that I'm not sure I don't wish were different.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I really, really love lots of things about it.
But
you know?
I do think there is a lot of self-awareness in the way that they're
Absolutely,
handling all of
yeah.
this. I mean,
yeah.
you heard the theme song. It's
Absolutely.
You know, right there when they say crazy ex-girlfriend, she just comes out and says, that is a sexist term.
Like
they don't even keep that as subtext. I mean, there's in the first episode, there's a scene, and it's played for laughs, where she's dumping all her pills. You're sort of seeing this escalating series of very, very, very poor choices. I remember being so relieved getting to like episode 7, where they kind of come back to that you get into some of the consequences of that. I mean, because the first few episodes in particular, there's so many bad choices and so much following of bad advice
mm-hmm.
right.
that it is a little, it does make it a little tricky to relate to the show. You it's hard to fully attach to characters who are behaving in some cases so poorly. And I've liked the show more as it's drifted a little bit from each episode is the fallout from a terrible, terrible, terrible decision.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right. I will say that I think one of the characters, she's more of a minor character who gets kind of introduced in the middle of the season, is the neighbor.
Yeah.
Who, she sort of has this persona where she reminds me of April from Parks and Rec, where mm-hmm. she's kind of like droll and very blasé. And there's a scene where Rebecca is kind of knocking around on her neighbor's doors looking for someone to attend her party. And this neighbor looks at her and is like, sure, I'll come. You'd be like a good subject for my Psych 101 class or
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the subplot of that neighbor becomes like her looking at Rebecca as a social experiment. And I feel like that in a way really provides a check on all of the stuff that Rebecca does.
Yeah.
And I really liked that balance. And of course, that neighbor herself becomes a slightly more in-depth character.
Yeah.
Not much more, but yeah. she becomes a part of the story.
How do we feel about Josh's girlfriend?
I think I read somewhere a criticism of the show for the way it portrays that character as just venal and awful,
mm-hmm.
but that you need a villain. You need
yeah.
somebody to hiss and boo. And when she did Good at Yoga, that was a really fun song.
Yeah.
The most recent song she did, not as strong. It's number 18 on my list, by the way. But they can't all be gems. I like the character. I think it's a good performance. And I'm not supposed to like the character. I'm
yeah.
supposed to... And
it's kind of a thankless role.
Right.
And that Good at Yoga song brings up something else that I think it's fair to touch on, which is that in all of these, one of the things that's really, I think, brave about this show and sometimes imperfect about this show, they are very head on in like, we're going to do a hip hop pastiche.
Right.
Yeah. We're
going
to do
yeah.
The yoga song is very much a take on like, I would describe it as what white musicians think Indian music
exactly,
sounds like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think, again, as Stephen said, it's very self-aware, but again, you have those moments where you're like, I don't know about this. I'm not sure how I feel about the way they're doing this send up. And yet they often turn out to be really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How sustainable is this show?
Mm.
I think that's a great question.
I had a little bit of the same reaction to this show, which I love, to another show I love, Jane the Virgin,
mm-hmm.
where the title of the show makes it feel inherently unsustainable, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like Jane the Virgin is like ultimately is not going to be true to that title. There's so much growth over the course of these episodes just in relationships between these characters. She is occasionally actually helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Other people are occasionally actually helpful to her. The show isn't always going to be about that, right?
Before, as we tape this, the most recent episode, which was the first one they had after they got back from
right.
the break.
The beach episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
The beach
yeah.
episode really takes a step, I think, in the narrative to start to get away from the original setup, which has a whole bunch of, I think without spoiling too many specifics, there are a bunch of pieces of the premise that then she navigates for those first 8 episodes. One of which is the fact that obviously you don't tell the guy, I moved all the way out here to California because I wanted to see if I could hook up with you, my summer camp boyfriend.
From many years ago.
From many years ago. it tried to kind of, I think, advance both who Josh is and how she's functioning with people. I do think that the first eight were kind of that premise playing out. Now she's kind of, Greg doesn't like her, so there's this tension with him. And so, you know, but she and Josh are kind of friendly, which introduces a whole different set of complications for her. So I think they did take a narrative step that is designed to start to combat some of that.
Yeah. The first time you see a character besides Rebecca singing, it took me back because I thought that's what the show, I thought the premise of the show was, we're inside her head. Mm-hmm. And I think it's Paula who sings Face Your Fears, which is a great song.
Yep.
I think it's that moment when I see, oh, what's happening is she is changing the town as the town changes her. That's what I mean about growth. That's what I mean about this show actually not sticking to its very, very specific premise and allowing itself to kind of get a little messy.
Yeah. And I kind of like the fact that they chose as their kind of magical town this place that they're not really arguing has a lot of inherent magicness to it. It's not like I went to New York and I love New York, or even I went to Hollywood or I went to London or whatever. I think they're trying to emphasize that the town is only special to her because of the people that are there and the experiences that she has and the beach, of course.
I was going to say, four hours of traffic.
The beach isn't bad. But, you know, it's not as if she has moved to a place where she can argue, now my life is totally different and magical because I moved to this particular geographic location. Anyway, I will be eager to hear from those of you who are watching Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. Come right back.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/happyhour.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is that time when we tell you what is making us happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
This is not going to be a huge surprise to those who know me, but Kung Fu Panda 3. It's so good.
Oh, Kung Fu Panda 3.
Can you be dispassionate enough to tell me if it's better than the second, better than the first? Well, like, just truthfully.
I think it's comparable to the second. The first one is by far the funniest. The first one is just packed with jokes. I have said for the longest time, if Kung Fu Panda were called The Dragon Warrior, it would have made a fifth as much money, and it would be an animation classic. Those movies are way better than they're given credit for because they're called Kung Fu Panda. Now, I will say,
I love this. I love that you say that despite the fact that the only reason anyone made this movie is that it was called Kung Fu Panda.
It's so good. So, okay, so what's it about? There's this panda.
Right. Oh.
No, the first one is very funny. The second one is going a little bit more into, like, how he was orphaned and is definitely a somewhat sadder Kung Fu Panda.
More serious backstory.
A little more serious backstory. And it is like this movie. First, they're both directed or co-directed by a woman named Jennifer Yu, who did just this beautiful work. Both 2 and 3 are visually spectacular to look at. There were scenes in this movie where I just kind of gaped at it and was just like moved by how pretty it was. And yet it is a movie about a silly panda.
Do you cry at Kung Fu Panda?
I do cry at everything, though. I cry at all the things. I cried at this. It is one of those movies. Thank you, Linda. It is one of those movies where the closing, like an animated movie where the closing credits are like 12 minutes long because just entire cities of people were involved in making it look and sound as good as it does. But, you know, people are very excited about their Star Wars trilogy. For me, the Panda trilogy. That's what it's all about. They're actually similar. In this one, like in Return of the Jedi, it has lots of cute little Moppity characters around, I think handles it better.
Nice.
Anyway, Kung Fu Panda 3, I enjoyed it a great deal.
Thank you very, very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, can you possibly top...
Oh, I don't know.
Kung Fu Panda
3. Two things. Gilmore Girls is coming back.
Yes,
because it's official. Everything comes back. Mm-hmm. Everything comes back now. So that fills me with 80% excitement, 20% dread.
Sure.
I think that's pretty safe fuel mixture there.
Anticipointment,
exactly, as you say. And they're getting a lot of the original cast. Yannick Truesdale, the amazingly named Yannick Truesdale, who played Michelle, tweeted a photo from the first, you know, cast read. That was very exciting. The Wikipedia tells me that Yannick Truesdale quit Hollywood and moved to Montreal to open a spinning gym, which, if you know the character of Michelle... He's a little on the nose, maybe. But, yeah, I'm very excited about that. It's coming back to Netflix. I think it'll be short, like maybe 6 episodes.
Yeah.
That's what they should do. Thanks, Netflix. The other thing is that Agent Carter is also back.
Oh, yes.
It's unfair to compare Agent Carter, which this season has 6 episodes, the first season had 8, to something like Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which has 20 or 22.
Uh-huh.
But let's do it anyway. This show is so much better. because it's a testament to... the second draft, to going back in, and when you have a bit more time, saying the reason the show is so much better is simply the dialogue. It's a high-concept show, so there are going to be long clots of exposition, right? You have to explain things. But there is never a moment, never a passage of dialogue that happens on Agent Carter that is simply giving you information. Always we get characterization. Infused into the dialogue is how the character feels about the information they are imparting or not imparting. It's a testament to saying, go back, try again. Instead of just simply getting us, being the connective tissue, let's make this flesh. Let's make this real. Let's make this rounded and good. The performances are fantastic. The tone is perfect. I have no idea what's going on. because, again, plot. Who cares about plot holes? It's a stupid thing to worry about. Don't worry about the plot. Worry about the characters. Make me feel what they feel. Make me understand them. And that show does it well. Agent Carter, it's worth your time.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. All right, Miss Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week, lady?
What's making me happy is, speaking of things that should have comebacks, I've been kind of watching the show Wishbone again. Yeah,
no.
What's the story? Wishbone.
Yes.
Do you guys remember that?
Uh-huh.
So basically,
our producer Jessica Reedy is pumping her fist in the booth.
Oh my God, it's such a good show. So basically, in that show, there is a live and real Jack Russell Terrier, and the dog sort of... I mean, he doesn't talk in real life, but in the story life, he kind of brings the viewers...
They didn't get an actual talking dog.
No, it's like a... It's such a good show. So this dog kind of introduces the readers to a live-action retelling of a classic book, classic literary whatever. And so I decided to start rewatching them to kind of figure out how true to these books they are. Because, you know, I would say that growing up watching Wishbone, it became the thing that I could use so that I wouldn't actually have to read books. Like, I don't think I ever read The Tale of Two Cities, but I watched The Tale, the T-A-I-L of
there
Two
you go.
Cities.
See what they did there.
Yeah, see what they did there. In this first episode that I watched, you know, it was kind of a letdown, I have to say, because it was about the adventures of Tom Sawyer. Not as accurate as the real thing. And so I felt like, on one hand, I got to really sort of relive this childhood experience, but then I also, on the other hand, got to, you know, have my dreams and knowledge crushed.
Oh, sure.
This is a ritual that you will repeat many times as you age, Kat.
I know, but...
You're just getting old enough to be disappointed in this particular way.
With Wishbone, too, man. Mm-hmm. But still a good show.
Is it Canadian? It feels Canadian.
No, it was shot in Allen, Texas.
Really? Okay.
I would advise, if you do watch the show, if you do decide to YouTube it or whatever, do not Google how old the dog is, because it will make you very sad.
Oh, no.
But on that note, that's actually what's making me happy.
That
the show,
awesome.
not the Googling.
That was absolutely awesome. I loved that so much. Thank you very much, Kat Chow. As you know, if you listened to this show a couple weeks ago, we had as our fourth chair my dear friend Sarah Bunting, who works over at Previously.tv and is on their Extra Hot Great podcast and there again with this podcast. This week, well, after we had Sarah on the show, I should say, people began asking on Twitter, like, why haven't you been on Extra Hot Great? Like, asking me, why haven't you guested on Extra Hot Great? Hey, Extra Hot Great, why don't you have Linda on the show? Which is an incredibly awkward thing for people to do, because they don't necessarily want to answer that question in front of me, and I don't necessarily want to guess. So when people are like, how come you haven't been on Extra Hot Great? You don't want to be like, I don't know. But anyway, the point being, by the time you are hearing this podcast, you will be able to hear me on Extra Hot Great, which I taped with them this past weekend. Now, as you know, if you listen to Extra Hot Great, they have a very special and important segment called The Canon, in which they all vote. This is the original Television Without Pity founders, Sarah Bunting, Tara Ariano, and Dave Cole, plus Joe Reed, who I worked with at Television Without Pity and who I lived with in Brooklyn for a year. They all vote on a submitted episode of television to see whether they will put it into the canon, which theoretically is this hall of fame of important television. But if you make a good enough case, you can sometimes get something in there that's not completely serious. So after considering a variety of options, I submitted to the canon during my guest appearance an episode of Dear to Glenn's Heart, in a certain way, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, a show which is like the 90s concentrated into a paste and then smeared on toast. So I submitted it to the canon. I'm not going to tell you how it turned out, but I will tell you I didn't really care how it turned out. I just wanted to spend 15 minutes describing an episode of Lois and Clark and playing clips, which is what I did, which is the most fun thing to do maybe in the world. And it was great fun. And we talked about American Crime Story, which is the O.J. Simpson thing coming out on FX. I talked about Rehab Addict. If you're a person who watches Rehab Addict, I talked about the Nicole Curtis and Rehab Addict and a bunch of other stuff. It's a terrifically fun show. I had a great time. It was the first time, I think, that the entire bullpen that I worked with in New York during the time that we all worked there together, Sarah and Tara and Dave and Joe and I, it was the first time we had all been together and done something together. So it was really pretty exciting and fun. So again, it's called Extra Hot Great, and you can find that as well as all their other cool stuff at previously.tv. So that is what's making me enormously happy this week. I was so excited to do it. So thanks to them for inviting me, and I hope that you will give it a listen, if only to find out what happened to Dean Cain. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Kat at Kat Chow. That's KATCHOW. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now and will be doing during several upcoming musical numbers. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.